All right, into the 9 o'clock hour we go. A text pops up from 7449 saying Tommy just drove by an accident in New Orleans East, so they got the eastbound I-10 closed. A car flipped lane in the middle of the interstate between the east and the twin span. We'll look into it and keep you posted on that. January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and Saturday was National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. We were supposed to have Scott Vaughn on Friday to talk about that and about what he does with Unbranded, but the Archer Barrier thing happened and the CEO was in town, so we had to bump him. But we wanted to have him on today to talk about Unbranded and human trafficking in general. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Scott's his dad is a former NFL official. He's a former SEC official. Do you remember on a lighter note before we get started here, the most heated argument you ever got into on a football field with a coach?
You know, my position was out on the middle of the field, so I tried to stay out there and avoid the sidelines as much as I could. So I didn't
You just noticed them nodding, and I just, if they're saying, yeah, okay, sure, fine, whatever. Is that pretty much it?
Well, you know, the big thing is if the coaches knew the rules, we wouldn't have so many arguments with them.
There you go.
Unfortunately.
There you go.
Unfortunately,
right.
You know, they get paid millions of dollars to coach these college football teams, and they don't know the rules.
Let's talk about Unbranded, Scott. First of all, before we get to Unbranded, about human trafficking and how big of a problem it is, because this just floors me when there can be slavery existing under our very noses.
Yeah, you know, that's true. It seems like slavery is more prominent today than it was over 200 years ago, but it's just not talked about that much.
Wow. Tell me how bad the problem is.
Well, I tell you, you know, currently hundreds of thousands of boys and girls throughout the United States are being sex trafficked, and hundreds of thousands of more are at risk every day of being sex trafficked. So, you know, we're trying to help with the prevention part of that on the front end, but we're also involved on the treatment aspect of it by removing the tattoos that are placed on these boys and girls by a sex trafficker that claims ownership of a human being.
Tell me about that for people that don't know. You deal with this every day, Scott, but people listening, this might be the first time they heard about it. You're talking about almost like sometimes a barcode or just a mark where it's like they would do with branding a piece of cattle or a cow or something like that, right?
It really is no different than a rancher would brand his livestock to claim ownership. So what a sex trafficker does is he puts his brand on a boy or a girl so that other sex traffickers know who that boy or girl belongs to. And it could be the trafficker's name. It could be a symbol. It could be a bed of roses. It could be a barcode. It could, you know, I've seen crowns, the cash emblem. Also, I've seen lots and lots of different varieties. But, you know, and then when a sex trafficker will sell a boy or a girl to another sex trafficker, then that sex trafficker puts their brand on that boy or girl. So they end up with multiple tattoos on different areas of their body. And then we come in and we remove those with state-of-the-art laser technology that I have in my clinic in Metairie. And it just is very crucial and critical to the healing process for these boys and girls.
Well, and just as people get a tattoo to remember something that they want to remember fondly, right? The opposite is true when it comes to what your organization does in removing these tattoos, because I would think it's hard to move on when you're looking at this and you have a constant reminder of it.
It is. You know, as I always say, these boys and girls can go to a psychiatrist every day and feel like they've made some progress, make, you know, 3 or 4 steps forward. But then when they get home in the evening or afternoon and they look in the mirror and they have that constant reminder slapping them in the face of the physical, mental, and sexual abuse that they endured for however many years they did it, then they take those 3 or 4 steps back. So it really is crucial in the healing process for these boys and girls.
And it's not a pleasant thing to talk about, but I do like to have you on occasionally to, because so many different things have different facets and different sides to it and different layers. And when it comes to sex trafficking, the healing portion of it is important. And part of that healing is getting rid of the tattoos. And that's what Unbranded is all about. You guys also have a raffle going on with Super Bowl tickets that it has the blessing of the NFL officials, correct? Tell me all about that.
Yeah, you know, that's correct. Back in May of 2024, I reached out to the National Football League Referee Association because of my affiliation and contacts with them over the years. And I told them about the nonprofit that we started and what exactly what we did. And when they looked into it and vetted us, they voted unanimously to support us. And the way they did that, because Super Bowl 59 is being played in New Orleans this year, they've donated 10 Super Bowl tickets to our nonprofit organization. So what they wanted us to do is get donations for the raffle tickets. So anyone that donates $200 will receive a raffle ticket to win two Super Bowl game tickets to this upcoming Super Bowl 59 that's going to be played right here in New Orleans. And since we have 10 tickets, there's going to be 5 winners. So there'll be 5 winners drawn, and each winner will receive a pair of Super Bowl 59 game tickets that's going to be played February 9th this year right here in New Orleans, so just next month.
How do people go about getting a ticket, Scott?
They can go to unbranded.org, and right on the homepage, it gives you all the information, and right by the image of the Super Bowl raffle tickets, there's a Donate Now button, and they can choose how many donations they want to make. And right now, we're doing a special to where if you donate $1,000, so five $200 donations, you'll get an extra raffle ticket. So you won't get 5 raffle tickets, you'll get 6.
I know.
And this is completely, you know, tax deductible. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so it's totally tax deductible.
And I just want to get to the legitimacy of your organization, because so many times people are jaded and they doubt this, they doubt that. For the NFL officials to get involved here, that is like the ultimate vetting that you could have, especially when it comes to Super Bowl tickets. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very pleased that they got involved and they see the importance of it. You know, just here in Louisiana between 2023 and 2024, we had a 74% increase in sex trafficking cases confirmed. And it's hard to put into words the boys and girls that I deal with and the stories that I hear while I'm doing the treatments on them. And it's just very disturbing and downright sickening that goes on here in our country.
I would guess, and the name of the organization is spot on accurate with Unbranded. I would think just as people share their stories when they're getting a tattoo, I guess sometimes you hear the negative stories when you're removing them, huh?
Correct. We do. You know, I hear the negative stories when I have a survivor or two or three together that are coming in to get the treatment. And as a provider, you know, they start to get more comfortable with me the more they see me, and they open up and they start to tell their story. And it's just very, very disturbing. I'm speechless every time they start telling their story.
I know you and I appreciate the work you do, but I just wanted to get this out there because I don't think anything can be more vetted than the NFL and the Super Bowl, because they are very, very protective of the shield and the brand and everything else. So the name of the organization is Unbranded. He's got some Super Bowl tickets or Unbranded. The NFL officials gave them some Super Bowl tickets that they're raffling off, and it all goes to benefit Unbranded. Tell me again, Scott, how people get tickets.
They can go to unbranded.org, and right on the homepage, there's an image of the Super Bowl raffle tickets and a Donate Now button. And I want to let everybody know, too, the money that's raised for this, we're going to be able to purchase a portable laser, because weekly I have different organizations around the state of Louisiana that are reaching out to me and trying to figure out how they can get the boys or girls that are being taken care of in their organization, how can they get them down to Metairie? And it's just for transportation reasons, it's kind of a logistical nightmare to be able to do that. So we'll be able to purchase a portable laser. We'll be able to buy the vehicle to transport the laser in, and we'll be able to travel around the state of Louisiana and go to the organizations where these boys and girls are being taken care of and treat them on their location, you know, in their facility. So that's just really going to be a game changer.
It's not pleasant to talk about. It's an ugly part of the healing process, of an ugly thing that's going on in society underneath our very noses. Scott Vaughn, thank you so much. Go to unbranded.org, was it?
Yes, that's correct. Unbranded.org.
And just generally speaking, for people, to be on the lookout for people that are being trafficked, what are some of the signs?
Well, you know, I tell in the speeches that I give, that the days of the white van circling the mall parking lot or the school parking lot are pretty much over. I tell parents all the time, pay attention to what your kids are doing on social media, because that's what sex traffickers use today. They use Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, any of those gaming platforms that kids get on, because kids don't really know who they're communicating with. You know, they may think they're communicating with another 14 or 15 year old boy or girl when they're really communicating with a 30 or 40 year old man or woman that's, you know, trying to traffic them and, you know, gain their trust so they can traffic them.
And once they're gone, they're gone.
That's it. That's correct.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your time and your work. God bless you all. Scott Vaughn, founder of Unbranded. You go to unbranded.org, find out more about it. January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and it is astounding how that can go on underneath our very noses in this country with so many young boys and girls, and it happens, and Scott sees the victims of them. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Dr. Judy Ho about keeping New Year's resolutions, also about the aftermath of Bourbon Street attack and dealing with collective grief, PTSD, and more. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. 9:27, we like to talk about mental health every other Tuesday here because we know it's very important. And we're joined now by Dr. Judy Ho, PhD, ABPP, ABPDN. Well, we're all grown ups, so we don't have to spell it. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
Hi, Tommy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books, Stop Self-Sabotage, The New Rules of Attachment. You can get those at the usual outlets. Dr. Judy, we were going to talk about New Year's resolutions, and we will, but I don't think we've spoken to you since the New Year started. And, of course, you know what happened on Bourbon Street. You lived here for a while. You're familiar with the area. What would you advise, or how would you advise people to deal with this? Maybe they weren't directly affected, but what can the area expect, I guess, maybe would be a better way to put it?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's obviously really difficult because essentially the whole community has been through a community-wide trauma. Everyone's response to it is going to be different, but you know, one thing that, part of the reason why I was in your neighborhood for a couple of years while I was a postdoc was that we were working with the Hurricane Katrina aftermath. And I remember working with the local mental health providers, and they themselves were having PTSD symptoms while they were trying to help their clients who had similar responses. And so it can be challenging because you're leaning on people in your community, which is what we all should do, but everybody's been through that trauma as well. And so I think that it's a tough part of it, but it's also what can be comforting because you know the person that you're talking to really knows what you're talking about, and they're empathizing from a shared experience standpoint as well, you know, as opposed to just saying, well, yeah, I think I might understand what that's like. But they don't really know, you know. So some pros and some cons with that. But I think overall, we have to just lean in with the people that we trust most and have the conversations to try to process through it at the pace that you're most comfortable with.
What are some of the things that collectively, maybe as the community, we might be feeling individually, but as it relates to something like this that we're likely to feel?
I think that, you know, there's a couple of the things that are the most common is many of the stages of grief. And so, again, people go through those stages in different ways. I don't think it's linear, but there are people who are going to be very angry. They're looking for who to blame and who to try to, you know, prosecute because of what happened. And then there are people who are going to be sinking into an existential crisis of sorts and become really depressed. There are people who are going to be bargaining, especially if they've lost somebody. It's like they're in disbelief, and it's like they're still trying to get that person back, even though they're not here anymore. Or maybe that person is a healthy person back if they've been one of the injured people. And then even just, you know, this feeling of denial, just complete denial that anything has happened. And there are some people who respond in that way because it's protective. Like, well, nothing's happened. I don't have to take any more precautions. I don't have to think about this neighborhood in any different ways. I'm just going to keep living my life. And of course, some of that is adaptive, but to a degree, it may not be, especially if you're putting yourself in harm's way.
Dr. Judy, I got to apologize to you because I got a lot of things zooming across the desk throughout the 4 hours and a couple of texts pop up. Is Dr. Judy safe in California? Give Dr. Judy my love. I didn't even ask about you and the fires in California, and I am so sorry about that. How are you? And I was focused on Bourbon Street and everything I'm doing here this morning. I didn't even think about asking you about that. How are you and your family and the area dealing with the fires?
Well, thank you so much for asking. We are fine in terms of where I live, but I have many friends and colleagues who've had to evacuate, and actually some who have completely lost their homes. So definitely very heavy feeling in our community right now. And similar to what I was mentioning to you, we have a mixture of responses as well to this tragedy. And there are people who are looking for someone to blame and to point the finger at, and that's making them feel productive. Other people who are still in denial about losing their homes. There are people who are really just, you know, still bargaining, like, well, maybe we haven't lost everything. Actually, one of my neighbors who just moved in across the street, you know, they just rented the place across the street. They said that their house in the Palisades completely burned down. And then her husband has been just kind of going by their place, like driving by the last couple of days, like just seeing if there's anything to salvage. I mean, so it's just, it's very sad, but it's also a completely understandable reaction that he's like, well, maybe there's something that hasn't burnt up and I can still recover it.
Can you, Dr. Judy, where you live, are you smelling this? Are you seeing this smoke all the time? Is that, I'm just trying to get a feel.
Yes. Yeah, we have a lot of ash. I mean, this is, it sounds ridiculous to even say that that's a problem, but yes, we have a lot of ash all over our yard and at our front door. We just kind of sweep it every couple of days. I mean, it's insane only because the nearest fire is about maybe 10 miles away from us. Mm-hmm. And we're still getting the ash blown. The air quality is impacted. So we've not been going outside on most days and staying inside and turning off all of our HVACs and things like that. But one of the worst fires, I think, is about 15% contained right now, but it's been over a week, so the progress is very slow.
So I don't know that much, and I apologize about California, other than having been there a couple of times. Is this something that's in the back of your mind? Is it something that could threaten your home or not?
We're not in a high fire risk area because we don't have a ton of vegetation around us. But I used to live very close to I just moved actually a few years ago away from essentially the epicenter of the fire. I probably would be in the next zone to be evacuated right now. So I was living in West Los Angeles. And so essentially Santa Monica and West Los Angeles, parts of it have been affected, but it's more the northern parts. I was living in the more southern part. So I would be maybe like a mile and a half away from where things are going on right now if I hadn't moved.
How important is it when you go through anything to talk to somebody about it? Because I think sometimes, I don't know if it's men more than women, you know, we want to be the and I'm dating myself here with the Gary Cooper, the strong, and I like old movies, the strong, silent type. Don't talk about anything. Uh-huh. Just stuff it way down there and just deal with it. And you say to yourself, nobody cares. Everybody's got problems. But how important is it from your own mental health standpoint? I'm talking about the generic you here, that people talk to others about their issues.
I think it is important. And as you mentioned, there are certain, maybe like the gender cultural norm, as well as certain other cultural norms, like in Asian culture, that's kind of how you're taught to deal with it too, for the most part, at least in mainstream Asian culture. It's like, just stuff it in and don't say anything. But I do think that there's value in processing it with a few people or even just one person. And everybody's pace of that processing is different, right? So there are people who want to talk about it for 30 minutes, an hour. And then there are some other people who maybe they just need to acknowledge that it's happening, you know, get some validation that they're not alone in how they're feeling, and then they can move on. But I think that it's very important that you express it in some way, even if it's a brief way to somebody, because when you try to ignore it, when you try to stuff it down, it's going to come out in other ways. And what I've seen most commonly is that it comes out in a physical way. People all of a sudden are saying they're having headaches, they get shingles, you know, they have GI problems, because your mind and your body are connected. And when you stuff something down and don't acknowledge it, your body essentially puts itself in a state of fight or flight, because it's like, well, something's going on. It's not being acknowledged, but I need to have my antenna up. And so it's actually really unhealthy for you, both from a physical and psychological standpoint, to not process it at all.
When it comes to the post-traumatic stress part of it, the delay, I guess, and I guess it goes to stages of grief, because I was thinking about that. Is it related to the denial and anger, acceptance, and everything else? That can apply to any type of loss, right? Because we associate maybe sometimes grief with the loss of a loved one or death, but all of those stages, first of all, have those been proven to be clinically accurate? And secondly, can that apply to any type of loss, whether it's a pet, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a job or anything along those lines, or maybe a bad health diagnosis?
Definitely, yeah. So I would say that with more research into the Kubler-Ross model, people have found that it's not necessarily linear, but that these stages are universal, in that most people experience at least a portion of them at varying times when they experience grief and loss. So you may not do it in that order that she first proposed, but that these are the common and most universal responses to any kind of grief and loss. And yes, it doesn't have to be the loss of a person. It could be the loss of your identity, the loss of a community, the loss of a stage in life, like when you were working and now you're retired, the loss of a type of relationship, like you had a certain relationship with your child and now it's a different kind of relationship. And grief and loss, and I know we've talked about this before, Tommy, but just any form of grief and loss is universal also to the human experience, right? Not every human experiences every single event or situation, but grief and loss is like something that every single human being will experience if you lived long enough, and multiple times in most cases.
Interesting point about the difference in the nature of a relationship between a parent and a child as they go through life stages, getting married, et cetera. We'll pick it up. We come back with Dr. Judy Ho, our good friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll talk about keeping New Year's resolutions. We've passed quit day, I think it is, when most people give up their New Year's resolutions, but it's not all or nothing at all. There are stages of this. We'll talk about it when we come back, 938, 22 till 10. Any questions, comments, Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and text lines open at 504-260-1870. Traffic now on WWL. 943, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tuesday morning. We like to talk about mental health occasionally every other week, and we do that with Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, let's talk about New Year's resolutions and making changes to your life, hopefully for the better. I know Dry January is something that's going around. I'd not heard about this, but apparently people quit drinking for a month. You know about this?
Oh, yeah. I've had some friends do that. And I think it makes them feel really accomplished. Like, hey, I can do this, and it makes me feel healthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody sets different kinds of New Year resolutions. I have not heard that there was an official quit day. What day is that?
Crucial quit resolution day happened last week. I forgot exactly what day it was, but it was a day where most people give up, at least not, I don't think it was something that you celebrate as much, and maybe I phrased that poorly, as much as just the day that, second Friday of January, January when, Tim? January 10th, when most people give up on their New Year's resolutions.
How interesting.
How do you...
Yeah, it makes sense.
Tell me why it makes sense.
Well, because people are so full of energy the first day of the year, like, oh my gosh, everything's going to change. And what happens is, of course, probably 10 days in, they've had, you know, one little setback, as everybody does. And then, like you were saying right before the break, people treat it as an all or none. They're like, well, forget it. If I couldn't do it on New Year's Day and I've already, you know, made a mistake so early, I should just give up. And a lot of people do give up by mid-January. But I think it's important to, one, not put so much pressure on yourself, and also, two, set your expectations that you're going to have setbacks. Like, if you go into this thinking you're going to have setbacks on your way to reaching your goal, then you're not going to be so surprised or upset with yourself or sort of be so black and white about it when an inevitable setback occurs, because it does for everyone. And also, one thing that I try to remind people of is that it takes about 4 to 6 weeks to make a new habit feel like the norm. So in the beginning, for the first month to month and a half, it's going to feel a bit treacherous. It's going to feel hard. And that is also normal. So I think sometimes people give up because they're like, well, I've been trying to do this for a couple weeks and it still feels like it's really hard. And that is completely normal from a brain science standpoint. Like, it just takes time for your brain to establish a new habit, and you have to give it a little bit of patience before you completely throw in the towel. Also, I think it's important to revise your goal. Like, if something isn't working for you, don't throw out the entire theme, but maybe think about, well, maybe I just aimed a little too high too quickly. So what is like a medium level goal that I can just focus on for the next couple of months? And then we can kind of reassess and see if I want to put the original goal back on the table after that.
And we set an artificial deadline. Like, you know, I can remember having gone through this as a younger person where it's like, well, that's it. Well, it's only January 10th. You still got a lot of time. You don't have to wait until next New Year's to try to do something different. Is it better from a behavioral standpoint? Somebody was talking, when was it? The other day, about running a marathon. 2 weeks ago, I had a conversation with somebody. Anyway, and they weren't a runner. And I said, well, I'll tell you, and I've never run a marathon, but what helped me get up to like 10 miles was, well, first of all, I've got replacement knees, so I would suggest you don't do that. I would suggest you go with the elliptical machine. But not to digress, but I started by running one house, and then the next day two houses, and then three houses and four houses, and it was amazing how quickly you could build up distance. Is it the same when it comes to modifying your behavior? Do you start with one day and then try to go to 2 days?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's a great example of how modifying your behaviors can really lead to success, as well as feelings of accomplishment along the way. Doesn't mean that you don't have your big goal that you visualize, like, okay, well, here's what I would like to do maybe in a few months or a year from now. But on a day-to-day basis, or on a week-to-week basis, it should be essentially steps on a ladder, right? To get to the top of the ladder, you have to have those smaller steps in between planned out. And also celebrate each step of that ladder. You know, sometimes people will say, well, I'll celebrate when I get to the top. But, you know, we as human beings were built to respond to more frequent positive reinforcement, not like waiting a whole year to get reinforcement. So reward yourself along the way. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could just be an acknowledgement of, hey, I did this. You know, one person that you trust, you know, sharing your progress along the way with them and having them celebrate you, you know, or just giving yourself a little treat here and there, like, okay, well, you know, I've done this for a month. I've stuck to these small goals along the way. Like, I'm going to treat myself to, you know, something. I'm going to buy myself something. Something small. It doesn't have to be expensive, but, you know, just to commemorate this. It is important that you earmark your achievements along the way. Otherwise, you do lose steam. You do lose motivation. And you also lose sense of exactly where you are. It's like, if you're not celebrating it, then you're also not reassessing and thinking about, well, what's working and what isn't. And assessing along the way and making improvements and adjustments is a huge part of that success.
Somebody texted in, and this is a kind of serious text about trying to quit drinking and having a hard time doing it. And how do you know when you have a drinking problem?
Yeah, good question. I think that when you know you have a problem, I think it's a couple of things. You know, some signs to watch out for is you can't stop thinking about drinking, and you try to cut down, but you're unsuccessful. And it's affecting major areas of your life, like how you function on a day-to-day basis, your emotional health, your physical health, or your relationships. If one or more of those things are happening, then I think it is time to think about cutting down on drinking, if not just stopping completely for a little while. And I think it's important to, well, first of all, if it feels really hard, consult a professional. But if you want to try it on your own, it's important to really remember why you're doing this. You know, what's the value of reducing or quitting drinking? And it's important to assess that, because otherwise the goal is going to feel empty. And then when things get hard, you'll just go right back to the drinking. For most people, drinking becomes just a habit. Like, it's just something that they start doing. But for other people, it's because it's a coping strategy. It's like a way that they escape something that they need to deal with. And so if that's the case, you need to learn other coping strategies to help you to deal with emotional stress, physical stress, anything that's going on in your life. Don't rely on alcohol, because, of course, the next day the problems are there, plus the problems that were caused by you drinking too much alcohol. So a big step is really just assessing why you're doing this and why it's important. And then I think from there, it's just about substituting in something else that might be healthier.
Let me wrap it up with this. Somebody wants to go back to post-traumatic stress syndrome because we addressed it earlier, but they said they're watching the fires in L.A. here in New Orleans, and it's giving them some Katrina PTSD because it's a joyous place that's kind of turning into hell. And you have kind of experience with both, right, Dr. Judy?
Yeah. So it can be really tough. I think that natural disasters, I mean, they definitely can trigger, even if it's a different kind of natural disaster, right? Just like kind of the wake of it and how apocalyptic everything looks. I would say to this listener that it might be helpful to step away from the news a bit. I mean, it's like almost feels like a train wreck you can't turn away from, but I think it is important in terms of protecting your mental health to step away from the news or just only, you know, set a timer essentially like, okay, 30 minutes of news and I got to turn it off and do something else, because otherwise it really does color your thoughts and how you feel. And I know that from experience from both this natural disaster as well as, you know, as you mentioned, being a peripheral experience of Katrina.
Dr. Judy, thank you as always. We appreciate your insight and your advice, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay? Tell Luca hi for us.
We will. Thanks so much.
You
Take
bet.
Good care, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye.
Stay safe. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.